Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and welcome to Tech Tuesday. Coming up later, gadgets with Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com, and also Consumer Reports senior editor will be with us to talk about those high-powered and affordable desktops. So stay with us for that. Right now, we welcome back our social media advisors, Deborah Jasper and Betsy Hubbard, co-founders of Mindset Digital. They're both the former directors of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Journalism at OSU. It launched the first social media fellowship for journalists in the country.
So Hi,
that's
great
pretty
to be
cool.
Here.
Welcome, Deborah and Betsy, as well.
Glad to be here, Ann.
Okay, so let's get back to Facebook because there's just so many changes, and we only have a little while this week to talk about
it. Not nearly as much time.
Yeah, we can only scratch the surface, but we were going to move into kind of getting into the issue of, all right, Facebook's great for your friends and, you know, catching up and on photos from summer vacation, but there's a serious side to it, too.
Right. Increasingly, Facebook is starting to be used in a more professional way. So recruiters are starting to look at Facebook when they think about recruiting. People are starting to think, with the timeline coming out, you know, is that going to be my new resume? How do I have to think about what is my persona on Facebook and what does that mean for me professionally?
So with the timeline and the resume aspect of it, how do you make it into a resume? How does that work?
Well, people are just saying it's being seen
whether
as a
resume.
Like
it or not.
Whether you
okay.
like it or not, because I can go on and see sort of the story of your life. And if I'm a recruiter, you know, I can make some decisions about who you are when I'm thinking about hiring you. The stats today, and this isn't just for Facebook, but they're saying that about 91% of recruiters are searching social media before they're making a decision about whether to hire you or not. And about 69% have decided not to hire someone based on what they found. So increasingly, we're saying, look, everybody out there has a digital footprint, and you need to know what your digital footprint is online. We had a student, for example, you know, we teach a graduate class. We were teaching on the impact of digital media on public policy, and he said that a recruiter said to him, hey, you want to tell me about the crack cocaine conviction up in Cleveland? He was interviewing for a job at a law firm, and he said, what crack cocaine conviction? And it turned out there was someone with his same name who had been convicted of a drug offense in Cleveland. So you have to know your digital footprint and know what else is out there. Maybe it isn't even you. So if you're looking for a job, you have to make sure you're telling people, hey, that person isn't me. We have the same name.
There's another side of the coin lesson there, though, for recruiters.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, not to make too many assumptions. Make sure you know who you're looking for.
Right. And don't believe everything you read online. I mean, right. you do have to. There's a lot of information that's available, increasing amounts of information available about all of us online. Doesn't mean it is all accurate. But again, as Deborah was saying, it's worth knowing what impression they might gather from you online. And there's a couple of tools that you can look at that will help pull information. So there's a website called people.com, and that's PIPL.com. And that does what they call a deep web search, because it will start searching into databases and uncover public information about you. Now, if you have a common name, it will pull up a lot of information, but you might be surprised by what it turns up. It's often will turn up addresses and cell phone numbers and, you know, maybe the value of your house, auditor records, things that are out there but are difficult to search in Google right now.
That used to be, difficult to search in Google. But now it aggregates data that as a journalist, a former journalist, I would have spent, you know, maybe months trying to track down, and it can do it literally in minutes. We've had people, we do those 3-day camps, you know, those fast forward camps, and we have people use this tool and they'll say, I had an insurance license for 5 minutes 20 years ago and it's on here. Or we had someone say, we had a CEO say, I testified before Congress in 1994. I completely forgot I did this and my entire testimony is here. So it goes back into databases and tells you all kinds of things about yourself.
If you're just joining us, my guests, Deborah Jasper and also Betsy Hubbard, they're co-founders of Mindset Digital. If you have a question for them, get to it, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet at Ann Fisher, WOSU, and you can go to the Facebook page, speaking of the devil social media.
Right, and you can tweet at #TechTuesday, or hashtag TechTUES, because I'm looking at that
Tech Twos. TechTues. Hashtag that, and then we'll get to it. And also, anyone out there who has either hired via Facebook or been gotten a job via Facebook, or maybe has not gotten a job because of Facebook. That would be even more interesting in a way to talk about. So give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, though, the word of caution when you're looking at something even like people.com, P-I-P-L-E, is sure. You can't necessarily believe everything you read.
No, Some of these things can be wildly inaccurate. We did have another instance in our camp where someone applied for a job at a state agency, and they said, do you want to tell us about that conviction? They thought he'd been convicted of shoplifting, and it turned out he had just been the clerk in the Walmart. And his name was on the police report, but he was the clerk who, you know, the shoplifter went through and they caught him. So he actually had to get, and this came up through social media, and he had to, through the, one of these searches, and he had to get a police report and send to the state agency to show that it was not his conviction. So we're seeing a lot more of this kind of these kinds of errors, you know, there's a lot of misrepresentations online, and you have to be cognizant of what your own digital footprint
is. And be ready for it, if nothing else, the interview comes. And by the way, that blip back in whenever, what about people who have been naughty on Facebook, maybe exposed a little too much, you know, too much information on Facebook? Mm-hmm. What can they do to go back and remedy that at this point? Anything?
Actually, it's so funny. There's a field that a lot of us have talked about called search engine optimization, where you spend a lot of time, you know, trying to get your company to the top. So if someone searches for you online, your company's name comes up first. But there's something new called search engine suppression.
Okay.
And it's basically paying to get information to go below the first.
Who
you know,
do you pay?
You know, a number of companies will do this. But even companies like Reputation.com, you know, there's companies out there that are now specializing in helping you manage your online reputation, and they have some of these features built in.
Right. We're not recommending them.
We haven't tried them. We're not endorsing them.
You're just saying, hey, there's a market for this. So increasingly, companies are saying, if you're worried about your reputation, we will search the web. We will tell you mm-hmm. what's coming up about you. And for a fee, we will try to get things suppressed.
Yeah. And we should make it clear that in Facebook, we've been talking about the new timeline that is still, you know, going to be unrolled, according to Facebook. Within that, you do have control over who sees your posts. And so everything you've done on Facebook doesn't become public automatically. And you also have a time to go in and edit that. So if there are stories that you don't even want your friends to see anymore, you can go in and delete those or hide them or take them out of your timeline. So you have some control over this. It's just you have to put in a little effort to manage it.
Do you see people just getting off Facebook?
A few people have, but as Betsy has said last week, yeah. I think the trade-off, a lot of people, we're spending 23 minutes a day on average on Facebook. That's an amazing amount of time. And a lot of folks are really addicted to this channel. They don't want to give up Facebook. I keep up with an awful lot of folks on Facebook, both professionally and in my personal life. And it's an important channel for me. So that's... I don't see people leaving it in droves, at least not yet.
People contact me via Facebook to pitch shows, show ideas, and I contact people to get them on the show.
Right.
And it's almost like when all else fails, and sometimes I'm thinking maybe it ought to be the first step.
Right. Because don't you find, we found this with students. I mean, students are tuning into Facebook a lot more than they're tuning into their email. And probably you find this sometimes with guests. Do they respond faster mm-hmm. if you get in touch with them via Facebook? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And 9 times out of 10, they have it up.
Yeah. Right.
So it's good. There's going to be a little blip on their screen saying there's something you can ignore. Yeah. But then if they see it's from Ann Fisher, then of course they jump too.
We were working with a company the other day and they were, they have a firewall. And they were saying, well, our employees don't get on Facebook. And we were giving a talk to about 300 people. And we said, and how many people are checking Facebook, on their phone? And the vast majority raised their hand. And I looked at the manager and said, and how's that firewall working for you?
And is that necessarily something they want, them not to be on Facebook?
Right.
If people are starting to use it professionally, if people are contacting each other, it's just another way like texting or cell phones or anything, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing that. I mean, workplaces have sort of shifted from their initial response, which was much like the initial response when the internet came out and everyone said, or emails. And everyone said, well, we can't put that on your desktop because you might play solitaire all day long. That's sort of the first response is this is really scary and you'll waste time. And then over time, companies get a little more familiar and they recognize that it's a management issue, that it, like anything
it's
else,
a tool.
Employees can waste time, you know, around the water cooler. You find a way to manage that, find a way to manage the expectations around what people can and can't do on social media.
And, you know, talk about recruiting. The military has found this to be such an important tool that they are basically saying, look, we are anyone in the military can use these channels. And we often say, OK, the Marines probably have security issues. And if they can figure out how to let soldiers use Facebook, then probably a lot of us can too. We're not saying that the security issues don't exist. They do. But you have to be smart about how you train people, and then you get smart about how you use these channels. But if you're the Marines, where are you going to recruit people? Facebook. I mean, that's a great tool for recruitment. There's a lot of folks that, at the age that the Marines are looking for, using Facebook.
In your work that you've been doing for a few years now, consulting one way or the other, has the conversation with companies, with private companies, gone from how to control it to how to use it?
Yes.
Have the conversations been changing?
We often say think influence, not control. I mean, you really can't control these channels. Everybody has their own channel, and you can't tell people what they can and can't do. I mean, you can obviously issue guidelines, but good luck with saying, hey, you absolutely can't get on these channels. There's legal issues around that. So now people are starting to think about, how do we influence our employees? You know, how do we get them to do the right thing? How do we make sure they've been through the right training? But simply just saying no isn't really working a lot of times.
The forbidden fruit tactic doesn't necessarily work. And also, I'm finding more and more people on Twitter, and not so much on Facebook, but mostly on Twitter, where they're saying in their description, the thumbnail, and none of the views in this, you know, are my own only, and they don't represent anything I work for. And I'm thinking, okay, how really realistic is that? That's nice,
yeah,
but...
Right, but they do represent who you are and, you know, by extension, who you work for. So it is part of your public persona. There's a case just about a month ago that received a lot of attention where an aide on Capitol Hill was trying to say all her tweets are off the record. Well, you're publishing them publicly. You know, you really can't
claim. Anybody can read your tweets.
Anybody can read them. Then they're not really off the record, and you have to, you know... You have to acknowledge that what you put out there is associated with you, and you have to take responsibility for it.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I mean, it's very these are really public channels. And if you are operating in any kind of public arena, it's not realistic to think that you can say this is not a reflection on me because you're tweeting. Of course, it's a reflection on you. Wiener learned that the hard way, right?
Representative Wiener, ex-Representative Wiener,
ex-Representative Wiener
from
New
Jersey. I've forgot New Jersey or New York.
Right. But we say he made more mistakes on Twitter than just not understanding how Twitter works. I mean, there were bigger mistakes at issue there. So,
and conversation for another day, maybe when as political season heats up.
Yes,
we'll move into that topic area. For now, I want to say thanks to Deborah Jasper. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Also, Betsy Hubbard. Thanks, Betsy, for joining us again.
Thank you, Ann.
Betsy and Deborah are media consultants and co-founders of Mindset Digital. They'll be back with us in a couple weeks. We're going to take a break next week for Fun Drive, but in a couple weeks, we'll see you then.
Great.
Sounds great.
See you then.
We'll be right back. We're going to talk with Consumer Reports' Donna Tappellini about those high-powered and affordable desktop computers. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and time is running out on your opportunity to win an iPad 2 and support our station. Our fall membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge early, you will be automatically entered to win an iPad 2. Visit WOSU.org now, make your pledge, and get registered. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. The deadline is October 13th. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus. 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
Partly sunny skies today, a high of 75 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Desktop computers are setting new performance standards, and Consumer Reports now includes new performance measures to reflect that. Joining us now in our weekly Consumer Reports segment to talk about the changes and answer your questions is Donna Tappellini. She's senior editor for Consumer Reports. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Good morning. Thanks, Ann.
I just want to let people know, too, you can get Consumer Reports online now. Go to consumerreports.org to learn more about that. Today, we're talking about desktop computer memory and what you need to know when you buy your next desktop, or we can talk about laptops as well. So, Donna, tell us, in the latest Consumer Reports, it says that desktop computers are setting new performance standards, and you've raised the bar, too. How so?
Well, Intel recently, and I guess AMD, too, the other major processor manufacturer, changed what processors are trying to do. So what's happening is for a long time, everybody was interested in word processing and how quickly they can get something done on an Excel spreadsheet. And obviously over the past several years, multimedia has become more important and processor manufacturers have kept up with that. But they've kind of stepped it up even more as they see people doing things, you know, more with combining their computers and their TVs and their music and everything else. So, so the processors are just a lot more geared toward that. So we changed our tests around a bit too, and the benchmarks that we used to measure a lot more multimedia functionality.
So do you have to get a new desktop, or is there something in the meantime while you're shopping for one that you can do to ramp up the one you have now?
Well, you can always, well, maybe not always, but you can often ramp up your computer, you know, depending on what you want to do. They're not going to be able to be really fast at the things that I just described, no matter what you do to it, like a 4 or 5 year old computer. But if you find your computer is getting kind of sluggish at this point, but you really don't want to buy a new one, and you do lots of word processing and spreadsheets and things like that, it's really easy to toss in a little bit more memory, random access memory. If you bought it 3, 4, or 5 years ago, you probably only have a gigabyte. So, but the cases of desktop computers and laptops leave you room to expand that, and you can get that pretty cheap.
So, how much memory or RAM, whatever, is enough?
Most manufacturers with desktops are selling like about 8, and that's plenty. 4 is probably plenty as well. But like I said, it's so not expensive. It doesn't really add that much to the cost of a computer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donna Tappellini. She's senior editor for Consumer Reports, and she's here with us for our regular Tech Tuesday conversation. We're talking about desktops, computers, memory, how much do you need, how much do you want? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And for listeners, do you plan to make your next computer a desktop or a laptop? Give us a call and tell us why, 614-292-8513. Does the type of memory matter? For instance, if you're into gaming versus writing your thesis, you know, with the multiple spreadsheets kind of a thing, does it matter what type?
No, not really. It's not really the type. Like I said, it's the amount. And 8, which is in many computers, is more than enough for just about everybody. Laptops usually have 4, and that's also plenty. But the thing is, if you want to play games, maybe this is what you were getting at. That's a different story. If you want to play games, you want to have video memory, and that's what will help the graphics and obviously the video in the movies run more smoothly, and you know things will react the way you want them to react. So get something with a gigabyte of video memory.
So what computers, which ones in Consumer Reports' opinion have kept up with the technologies and are a good buy?
Okay, well, so here's what's going on. In desktops, you can get a regular, like what we call a full-sized computer. It's just what you have thought of as a computer for quite some time. It's just a, you know, a like a tower kind of a model. And Those are getting pretty low cost. You can get something right now in our ratings. We have things hovering around $500-$600 that are great, very good performance, or even excellent performance. But the thing that's happening, that's been happening over the past several years, but that's going to change probably in the next year or so, is all-in-one desktops are becoming a bigger thing. So the iMac is the big all-in-one desktop from Apple, and they always end up at the top of our ratings.
So what's an all-in-one?
Oh, sorry. Well, an all-in-one is you don't have that tower. You have all of the components of the computer, except obviously for the keyboard and the mouse. The components of the computer are built right into the monitor. So it's thin. It's just one piece. You don't have to have a monitor and a tower. It's just this one piece. And it's just more, you know, it's more convenient, and it's a space saver, and they're kind of cool looking as well. The other thing that's going to be changing with all-in-one computers in particular, several of them have touch screens now, such as HP's TouchSmart, which is another model that often ends up at the top of our ratings, the HP TouchSmart. And so they have a touch screen, and what's going to happen probably about a year from now, Microsoft will introduce Windows 8, and Windows 8 is going to be, it was written kind of with both tablets and regular computers in mind, so it's going to have a lot of touchscreen capabilities. So when you get an all-in-one desktop, you're likely to see a lot more with touchscreens now.
My guest is Donna Tappellini, Senior Editor for Consumer Reports. We're talking about desktops. We're talking about laptops. What do you want to talk about? 614-292-8513. Now, why aren't this new generation more expensive? Why are they so reasonably priced?
Well,
I'm used to just...
Well, computers have kind of become commodities, so they're just these parts that are manufactured, and they just don't cost a lot to produce. The other thing that's going on is the processors are getting better. They're getting smaller. They can fit a lot more onto a smaller processor. So it becomes just cheaper to manufacture. It's definitely to people's benefit. We have some laptops. Laptops have traditionally been a lot more expensive than desktops, and the laptop prices are dropping. And in fact, in the news today, you'll see Acer and Asus, two computer manufacturers, are introducing something, kind of a new category called Ultrabooks. And what an Ultrabook is, it's a laptop, but it's very thin, it's very light, and they're trying to keep the cost of these under $1,000. So where you used to spend significantly more for a small, very, very portable 13-inch laptop, you're now going to start seeing these Ultrabooks. And they're like just a little more than a half inch thick. They're emphasizing long battery life. We haven't tested them yet. They're just introducing the first two today. But the companies are emphasizing long battery life with these and low price.
How do you recommend people go about buying a desktop?
Well, so you want to decide what you're going to use it for. Is it going to be a family desktop? Then I would say get something with a touchscreen. We recommend the HP TouchSmart. Right now the one we have is the 610-1190F, not to get into all kinds of, you know, crazy numbers, but the HP TouchSmart, it's great for the family. You can put it in the living room, in the kitchen, and they have a special kind of family-oriented interface that's on it, so you can go in and leave people sticky notes or watch TV shows or, you know, do a variety of family kind of things. Again, if you want to save space, and again, an all-in-one is a good way to save some space with or without a touchscreen. If you're really into power and configuring and expanding, then you probably want a traditional kind of tower or full-size computer. And like we said before, if you want to play games, make sure you get something with a gigabyte of memory if you're, you know, if you're not going to be doing heavy-duty gaming, something with 4 or 8 gigabytes of memory, with a Core i3, i5, or i7 processor from Intel, you should be pretty well covered. And then the hard drives are getting really big. So a lot of manufacturers have like a terabyte hard drive, which just should fit more than enough songs and movies and games and whatever else you want to store on there.
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to say that a lot of times people buy memory when they don't need to, because what you need to do is look at the performance page on your operating system and look at the amount of memory that is being swapped out to the disk. And if there's a lot of available memory, then that's not the source of your performance problem, and you need to look somewhere else.
Yeah, but some people, a lot of people still do have just a gigabyte of memory on their computer, and probably adding a bit will really help up the performance. It's just a quick and simple way, and relatively cheap to take care of your problem. But I mean, yeah, as Jim points out, a lot of things could cause sluggishness in a computer. You know, it could be sometimes. Well, one thing you should always do that a lot of people don't do is turn your computer off every so often, because what happens is a lot of, you know, data gets kind of stuck in there, and if you don't turn it off, it makes it run more slowly.
Thanks, Jim, for the call.
Okay, sure.
Take care.
Thanks, Jim.
Got a few more minutes left with Donna Tappellini from Consumer Reports. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at @AmFisherWOSU, and you can go to the Facebook page as well. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. What about going online? When people go online and start to look at things online, would you have any recommendations for what sort of sites are helpful?
You mean for
shopping?
For shopping. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, we do surveys of thousands of users, and we rate the retailers that they go to. And if you want to go buy a computer on a website, not an Apple computer, but a Windows computer, Amazon, Newegg, Tiger Direct, they're really good sites for shopping. And Costco is also a great website for shopping for a computer if you're not real concerned about selection. They don't have a wide selection like a lot of other computer online retailers have. The great thing about Costco is they have a 90-day return policy.
Is that unusual?
Oh yeah, and you know, something to watch out for when you buy a computer is a lot of companies charge restocking fees, mm-hmm. Up to 25%, and sometimes even if you don't open the box. And some of them don't accept returns of computers that aren't effective, so you have to be careful, and look at the return policies.
And so if you just don't like how it operates, it's not defective, that's not good enough.
Yeah, and so you're stuck with it.
So. No buyer's remorse. Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, I had a question about the recycling aspects of computers and their greenness. And I'm concerned about, with people buying new computers so rapidly and so many ending up in landfills or recycling or whatever, and where the industry is headed with regard to more eco-friendly computers.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about that. We have been looking into that a bit more, and keep your eye out, because I think we're going to be covering that a lot more. It's a really, really important question. The question of people buying more and more and what are they doing with them. That said, a lot of computer manufacturers, and you should look and just be conscientious as you buy, a lot of them will take your old computer back for recycling for free. And even if it's not their brand of computer, some of them will take it anyway. So that's a really nice policy. I don't know which ones do that off the top of my head, but I know several of them do. So, you know, before you buy, you should definitely take a look and take that into consideration. And Mary makes me think of something else that's really important. If you are recycling your old computer, make sure you wipe your hard drive clean. And that just doesn't mean deleting. That means getting some, like an application. There's something called CCleaner that you can get free online, or Heidi, H-E-I-D, eraser, H-E-I-D-I, eraser. And that'll wipe everything off your hard drive so that no one can get on there and pull out your old files.
Mary, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Everett in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Everett.
Hello there. My comment and tip would be on speed would be defragging, because when I defrag,
defragmenting, computer, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is so much faster.
What is defragmenting?
Well, that's a great tip, and I believe Windows 7 will automatically do that for you in the background, but it doesn't hurt to do it once in a while yourself. And what defragmenting is when you use a program on your computer desk, or you know, several programs through the course of a day, it deposits pieces of the program and pieces of data. Actually, is a better way to say pieces of data. All over the disk, not in any particular order. It just sticks them where it can find some space. And if you defragment it, and if you don't defragment, the disk has to look around a little bit more for a particular piece of data. If you defragment, it kind of it puts all that data as close together as it can, and it makes it easier for the computer to find things as you're doing various tasks. So, yeah, that's a really great thing to do. You should do it regularly. Take a look in your Windows menus and make sure that it's scheduled to run every so often.
All right, Everett, thanks for that call. And Donna Tappellini, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, sure. It was fun.
Appreciate it. Donna Tappellini, senior editor for Consumer Reports. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeffrey Eugenides, the author of The Virgin Suicides and Middlesex. His new novel, The Marriage Plot, involves a romantic triangle between three graduating college students. One of the young men goes off to India to volunteer for Mother Teresa in a home for the destitute, sick, and dying, something Eugenides did as a young man. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And time is running out for your opportunity to win an iPad 2 and support our station. Our fall membership drive begins soon. By making your pledge early, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad 2. No pledge is necessary, but your support continues to pay for the programs you enjoy. So visit WOSU.org right now, make your pledge, and get registered. The deadline is October 13th, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
And join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow morning at 11 for the final months of the drawdown in Vietnam. With author Bill Shikurdy, join us for that discussion tomorrow at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today and a high of 75 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 55. All Sides continues on 89.7.
Is the phone camera replacing the point and shoot? Joining Tech Tuesday this week to talk about that is Russell Holly. Russell has worked all over the tech industry, from Geek Squad to server administrator, and now wields that knowledge as a tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Ann.
At the top of the hour, we used some sound from a conversation. Well, it wasn't a conversation. It was a recorded message from the Dalai Lama to Desmond Tutu in South Africa. And they also had a hangout, at least they were scheduled to have a Google Plus hangout on October 8th. So what happened last weekend, and last weekend, I guess, and what does that have to do with gadgetry?
So So some really cool things happened with that particular conversation between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. They used Google Plus's new video chat service called Google Hangout to have this communication back and forth. But what they also did, the guys at Google took that conversation and actually streamed it live on YouTube for the entire world to watch. And even now, that conversation is available recorded on YouTube to go back and watch.
So do we know how many people watched it?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I know that the actual conversation, when I looked at it yesterday on YouTube, had already had hundreds of thousands of views. It was about an hour and 15 minutes of recorded conversation between the two of them. And, I mean, they covered a pretty wide variety of topics. You know, everything from the three women who just won the Nobel Peace mm-hmm. Prize to, you know, some just kind of, you know, almost internal jokes, you know, inside jokes between the two of them, where they spent a lot of time, you know, just having a conversation. And that was one of the big things when Google first announced the Hangout that they wanted to try and accomplish, was that personal setting, you know, with a video conversation.
Now, I guess the interesting thing about this is that there are these two old guys doing it. I mean, the Dalai Lama.
Actually, one of the very first things you see when the conversation starts is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He leans in, and when he giggles to himself, and the first thing that he says is, "He's so clear."
Yeah.
So it was clear for both of these parties, you know, for both, you know, the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu to be experiencing this. They were both surprised at how well it was working.
So how does it work? I mean, it's just a line to line, but anybody can watch if you open it up.
So the Google Hangouts system right now can allow up to 10 people into a room to communicate with each other.
Okay.
And there are a couple of really neat things that make that a lot more functional than some of the other services that are out right now. The first being that whoever is talking, you have the 10 people across the bottom in an almost Brady Bunch like, you know, block on the bottom. And then as someone starts speaking, they're given a much larger window above in priority. So it allows for more dynamic conversation in groups of people. And a feature that is not yet available to everybody, but will be, you know, rolled out eventually, is the ability to take that Hangout and actually broadcast it on YouTube for people who are not interested in participating in the conversation, but just watching to, you know, experience the event.
I've had some pretty deadly conference calls in the last year, and I can imagine where the Hangout would have been very helpful to be able to see people and see who's talking.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And it's a collaborative tool as well with some of the integrations that they've done with some of Google's other tools like Google Docs. You know, having a document suite when you're, you know, having that communication with somebody, even if it's just a professional conversation between colleagues, you know, you can share information on that document in the same screen. So it makes it a lot easier to work in that space, as well as, you know, have some fun.
My guest is Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger with Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, and you can go to our Facebook page, as usual. All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page is always open for business. So Google has released a slew of updates for its social network, Google Plus,
mm-hmm.
just in the last day or so.
Absolutely.
What are we looking at there? And what does
a lot
that?
Of,
yeah, go ahead.
A lot of what they've done has been an almost they're seen as being, you know, pretty heavily competitive with Facebook right now.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've seen from a lot of people who have been experiencing Google Plus from the beginning is that it's not so much that it's a replacement for Facebook so much as it is a alternative style of conversation.
House,
a lot of times mm-hmm. you see on Facebook there's, you know, that someone posts a message and then their individual comments, you know, even some of the longer comments, you know, from my personal experience, they usually don't get too much further than, you know, say three or four sentences, maybe a paragraph or two. And the conversation stays, for the most part, in you know, kind of one sentence blocks in a line.
And this is different.
Well, Google Plus, they don't have a character limit for either comments or the individual posts. So it allows for a lot more information and, you know, similar to Facebook, you can pair images and video and, you know, links to other websites in with that information. And it just makes the conversation a lot more, I don't want to say dynamic so much, it's just a lot more content.
Now, I read that it's turning turning into the social network of choice for web and mobile collaboration. Why is that?
The reason that it's a choice for web and mobile collaboration is that it's integrated pretty deeply into a lot of Google services already.
Okay.
With Facebook, when you're on Facebook, you get notifications for Facebook. You know, all of the experience, the whole Facebook experience is contained within Facebook. With Google Plus, the social experience is actually contained across all of their, you know, all of their digital experiences. If you're in your Gmail account, if you're a Gmail user, the black bar across the top includes a Google Plus notification icon. The same goes with their documents and their calendar, and you know, all of those services now include, you know, quick access to Google Plus to either share information or to comment on existing things that you're already doing on the network.
It sounds like something that could really fit into a work, you know, into the office.
Useful. I would definitely agree with that.
So let's turn to the cameras. I mentioned that at the top. Is the phone camera replacing the point and shoot? You wanted to talk about that. Why? Because my kid just got a camera and I don't want... You're killing me, Russell.
So it's an interesting thing that's happened in the past in such a short amount of time. You know, when camera phones were first put in cell phones, it was really kind of a novelty thing. They weren't very good cameras. You could take pictures at things, you know, maybe 10 feet away, and it wouldn't be, you know, the greatest picture, but it was something you could have. And now these cameras are getting much, much, much better, you know, as technology is increasing, especially with smartphones, and most notably the release of the next iPhone from Apple. You know, it's, I think a recent thing that I read this morning said that over 1 million pre-orders had happened for the iPhone 4S. And that has an 8-megapixel camera in it, and it's definitely not a slouch. It's a pretty significant camera, and it's backed by some really impressive software that Apple includes that you know will digitally enhance the picture after it's been taken. The ability to take a picture isn't so much the important part, though. I mean, any camera can take a picture, and point and shoots are often, you know, especially now, are often cheaper than, you know, the $500 that you shell out for the iPhone 4S. But the important part here, you know, if you have a smartphone, if you're interested in the smartphone data plan, is the ability to not only take that picture, but immediately take that picture and share it to your Facebook, to your Google Plus. You can email it to somebody. You can text it to somebody. It's not that it's replacing the ability to take pictures, but what you can instantly do with those images that I think is significantly more important.
So is this something that... the camera companies ought to be very worried about, or should they get into the smartphone business?
Well, in some ways, they've actually tried to match this a little bit. There's actually a company right now that makes a card for most cameras on the market right now called an iFi. And this is actually kind of cool. It's a SD card that has a wireless transmitter in it, so that when you are connected to a wireless network, it has the ability to, if you set it up to do so, take the pictures from the SD card, or for example, an 8-gigabyte SD card. It will, when it connects to a wireless network, take those pictures and immediately upload them to either your computer or to a website that you've, you know, designated to receive those pictures.
Let's talk about that iPhone 4S sales. Were you surprised? They said it's the biggest pre-order of anything like this.
Well, there was certainly, you know, it wasn't so much surprise in my eyes, because the phone was released on 3 of the 4 major United States carriers, and that had been previously not done in a single release.
Right.
So the iPhone Sprint, 4 came Sprint. Out on AT&T and then Verizon later.
And now Sprint.
Right, and so now it's Sprint, but it's not just that it's also on Sprint, it's that it's all 3 at the same time.
Right.
You know, and pre-orders are available on all 3 at the same time. Though, interestingly enough, Sprint is not allowing new subscribers to pre-order the iPhone 4S on Sprint. Only existing customers can pre-order it. But it's still it's an impressive number, considering a lot of the tech community kind of saw the iPhone 4S as being kind of underwhelming in terms of the announcement, which I think was kind of a mistake.
Well, colored perhaps in part by the, you know, the death of Steve Jobs.
It could have perhaps been colored by the death of Steve Jobs. It could also be that, you know, Apple has, they took a phone, you know, the concept of the smartphone and changed it a little bit so that it became more of a, you know, a personal device. And now they've, you know, they've taken it so that it's an incredibly popular personal device, but the device itself, it doesn't need to have, you know, the most mind-blowing, you know, specs in the world in order to be a great device. And that's where I think a lot of the tech community was, you know, writing how it was a little disappointing. And I think that was because they, you know, everyone was expecting Apple to come and say, you know, this is, you know, your phone is now, it's got the same hardware as your desktop computer. And that's just not necessary.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe it could convey holographic images or something.
Exactly. Project my movie onto the wall for me.
When something like that happens, when something like the iPhone 4S comes out, what does that do to other segments of the, well, other the competition, say like the Droid or something like that? They have stuff that's supposed to be coming out in October too, right?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, Samsung and Google were planning a release of a device today, in fact, or an announcement of a device today in San Francisco that actually got delayed, you know, in respect for Steve Jobs' passing. But very, very soon they're going to unveil not only the next, you know, phone from those two, but also the next iteration of the Android operating system.
How fast do you think these iterations are going to start coming out now?
One of the things that I applaud Apple for is sticking to a relatively one-year cycle for a lot of their things, because it keeps things, you know, it'll create an environment where you expect a certain release at a certain time and you can kind of prepare things. You know, the Android operating system is available on many, many different devices, and it seems almost like there's a new Android phone coming out every other week in at some points of the year. So it's an interesting question to ask, because it's definitely going to vary. You know, Google has a history both with their browser and things like that to, you know, make updates as fast as possible, you know, keep that bleeding edge, you know, update to their system. And they've done a lot of that similar release cycle with their phones. And in some ways, it's actually caused them some problems as far as being compatible across the devices.
Let's go back to Steve Jobs for a second. What's your take on the future of Apple and everything it does? Have they lost their genius and that's it?
Well, there's a couple things to keep in mind. The first is that Steve Jobs has been not an active part of Apple since right around February. You know, Tim Cook has been, you know, unofficially running the show there for a while and has spent quite a bit of time with Steve Jobs to kind of, you know, get a sense for how he did things, but he's also gonna, you know, do things his own way as well. So I don't think that it's gonna be this drastic, you know, kind of drop off, but I definitely think that within the next 2 or 3 years we will see Apple, you know, possibly move in some different directions. And they may or may not be positive.
You know, it's funny when you say that Steve Jobs actually hasn't been directly involved since February, as if that's an eternity ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean,
6 months. You know,
it's a silly thing when you think about it. But yeah. In the tech community, that, you know, keeping with that bleeding edge kind of feel, you know, it can certainly seem that way.
So, just to get to know you a little bit, and listeners get to know you, tell us about what got you into the whole tech thing, and what you think the big technological breakthroughs of I don't even know how old you are, but you know, what do you think the big ones are? I was watching something on a History Channel that was talking about the biggest, you know, the most important breakthrough gadgets of our time. What do you think?
Most important breakthrough gadgets of our time. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. I would say that the most fascinating things right now are not so much, you know, the things that are, you know, things that we use every day, but really some of the breakthroughs that we're seeing in the medical field of technology, you know, which is not something that I focus on directly, but I tend to pay a lot of attention to. And you know, some of the technology, when you consider, you know, places, you know, hospitals that are using these advanced devices to, you know, go in surgically with no hands, no human beings, and perform surgery, you know, controlled remotely, that is a phenomenal thing to me. I would say that that's probably the most important thing, you know, that we've seen in the last, you know, 25 years.
And so what do you love about all this stuff that makes you blog about it for Geek.com?
Well, you know, I've always kind of been a fan of, you know, shiny new toys. But, you know, the biggest thing really is seeing how we are slowly moving towards, you know, having devices that are not the center of our universe. You know, the computer, if my computer breaks, if something were to happen tomorrow, if my house were to catch fire, you know, very few things on my computer are not instantly either replaceable or found elsewhere online. And I think that that's going to be a trend that starts to happen with a lot more people. You know, my photos, you know, I have three children. I have hundreds of thousands of photos of my family. And I know that if anything happens to my camera, my computer, or anything like that, that those pictures are safe.
It's not such a lockbox kind of a
exactly.
situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. What next week, what do you think we might talk about?
Next week, I would really like to talk a little bit about some of the things that have been happening, you know, as I just talked about a little bit there with, you know, storing data online, you know, covering things in a way that, you know, it doesn't matter what computer you're using, all of your data is accessible. Everything from documents to photos, you know, videos, all of the above.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that. Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And just to let everybody know that you can receive daily updates from our show by liking All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook or by following me, Ann, on Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU. And be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides. You can explore the video and audio archive of every show there. And you can also download podcasts from all of our guests and all of our topics. So visit WOSU.org/allsides for more on that. Want to say thanks to everybody, the All-Sides staff, producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, our All-Sides intern Corinne Gleckler. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, saw him today, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks to everybody, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting Tatiana Soli, reading from her novel The Lotus Eaters, a love story during the fall of Saigon, Wednesday, October 12th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.